This program is brought to you by Fresh FM.
Hello and welcome to Top Writers. I'm Galen Pound, and in a few moments I will be talking to theatre and film legend Paul Maunder. His film work includes Gone Up North for a While, Landfall, and Sons for the Return Home. His theatre work covers professional theatre, alternative theatre, community theatre, and theatre in education. He also has had 3 books published, and his stories have been read on Radio New Zealand National. He coordinates the West Coast community theatre group Kiwi Possum Productions. Their latest play, Helen and the Ferals, is on at the Mapua Community Hall tonight, Saturday the 9th of September at 7:30. But first, we're going to hear from Dana.
This is Dana Wensley, and I'm going to talk to you about freedom of speech in New Zealand. I'm the freedom of speech spokesperson for PEN in New Zealand. PEN is an international human rights organisation that represents writers who are imprisoned or persecuted for their work. I'm often asked about the history of PEN. The history of PEN is peppered with the names of writers imprisoned or persecuted like Eno Mamesi, Salman Rushdie, Aaron Atterbeck, and Rafe Badawai. Their stories serve as a chilling reminder for us to be vigilant about ongoing attempts to limit free speech. But New Zealand has its own history of speaking out, a history that is not often told and yet forms an important backbone of the history of New Zealand literature itself. This unique Kiwi story began with a man who referred to himself as a bookman, and it has blossomed today to become New Zealand Society of Authors. The man was journalist and writer Pat Lawler, and the year was 1934. These were important times for PEN, an organisation that was founded in London in 1921 to promote literature. Lawler started a branch of PEN in Wellington, known as the New Zealand PEN Centre, becoming its first secretary and later a president and treasurer. 4 years later, the first PEN Gazette was published. It's been said that in these early years, it was even harder for writers in New Zealand to earn a living than now. PEN became a vehicle by which the notoriously individualistic bunch of writers could unite to promote literature and creativity. Representing writers at a time where corrugated iron and number 8 wire were the raw materials most people admired was a mammoth task. In 1944, PEN New Zealand more than rose to the challenge when it lobbied government to establish the State Literary Fund, which was instrumental in promoting writers whose work would otherwise not have survived. The public lending right, allowing authors to receive compensation for loss of royalties through library use of their works, followed in 1973 through the driving force of novelist Ian Cross. Called the Authors Fund, it was the first of its kind in the world. By 1975, at the instigation of PEN member and renowned scriptwriter Michael Noonan, the New Zealand Writers Guild was born. Responding to the fact that writers finally had a chance to make a living for themselves from scriptwriting, brought about by New Zealand's first soap opera at the time, Close to Home, the Writers Guild was established to represent writers negotiating with broadcasting and professional theatres. PEN has adapted over the years in response to changes in legislation, most notably in 1994 when the government at the time replaced the Queen Elizabeth II Arts Council with the Arts Council of New Zealand. At this time, the newly formed Arts Council severed its relationship with PEN, causing it to swiftly change course to transform into the New Zealand Society of Authors. The resulting body seeks to remain true to the wider principles of PEN, while at the same time lobbying and promoting writers. In this form, the New Zealand Society of Authors has effectively advocated on behalf of writers, most notably its campaign to gain equal control of Copyright Licensing Limited, which was initially established by publishers. Over the years, PEN's members have included some of the notable names in New Zealand's literary history: Fiona Kidman, Michael King, Joy Cowley, Margaret Mahey, and Fiona Farrell have all been members. PEN has been kept alive with passion and commitment to its goals. PEN's Hubert Church Award for Prose, which was established in 1945, has promoted writers such as Frank Sargeson, Maurice Shadbolt, and Janet Frame. the Jesse McKay Poetry Prize, which is awarded to the best first book of poetry, has recognised poets such as James K. Baxter and Alan Curnow. In other countries, Penn stands alone from Society of Authors, something that allows it to retain charitable status and seek funding that is denied Penn in New Zealand under the current structure. Penn survives now through significant commitment of volunteers. Leslie Marshall volunteers her time as the coordinator of the New Zealand branch of the Writers in Prison Committee, and I volunteer my time as the Freedom of Speech spokesperson. The history of Penn mirrors the history of writing in New Zealand itself. There have been significant achievements, awards, disappointments, and restructurings along the way. No journey is ever easy. But the timeline for Penn shows it has risen above the challenges to meet the needs of writers and promote literature in New Zealand. If you want to find out more about Penn in New Zealand and become involved, contact me, Dana Wensley, at penn@nzauthors.org.nz, or follow the links to Penn on the New Zealand Society of Authors website at www.nzsa.org.nz.
I'm Galen Pound and you're listening to Top Writers. My guest today is Paul Maunder. Welcome to Top Writers, Paul.
Yeah, thank you, Galen.
Right, now your life has been dedicated to theatre and film. When did you first realise that they were going to be what you spent your life doing?
Probably at university. I mean, I was brought up in a working class family where the arts weren't part of our daily life, but I went to university and I joined the drama group there, and Richard Campion directed a couple of pieces, and he was a pretty impressive director. And I got the opportunity to direct a play myself, and when I did it I thought, yeah, I can do this, and this feels sort of right, really. And I suppose from there on, theatre became my first love. I think it's a way of being in a community, being in a family in a sense, of that interaction between people of which is more than daily life generally produces, put it that way.
Right. Now, you study at the National Institute of Dramatic Art in Sydney or NIDA,
yep,
and the London Film School. What drew you back to New Zealand?
It was a hard one, really. It was quite a hard choice to make because I'd been living in Sydney, because to go to NIDA, that was there. And then, I mean, 68, 69 in London at film school were pretty amazing years, actually, in terms of being there. But then, you know, what do you do? I suppose I didn't really want to live in exile, put it that way. And then I wrote to, I think, the ABC, and I wrote to the film unit, and there was a promising response from the film unit, so I thought, we'll come back. And when I did so, I suppose it was a bit of a shock to the system, in a way, sort of finding myself in New Zealand and not knowing the place particularly well, having that feeling of, you know, what is this place and where I've been brought up in, and then spending time finding out about it, really, I suppose, from there on, that whole search for, I mean, a sort of cultural roots here and what the place is about, and that move to, what does it mean being Pākehā and settler and all, you know, that whole cultural journey that's taken place since.
I remember when I was studying drama in London, a comment somebody made to me was that New Zealand is a young, fresh country and we are not bound by the traditions of England. How would you react to that?
Yeah, I mean, for me, it was more about the class system. I mean, the class system was a real shock for me. I couldn't believe it, you know. I mean, and it remained shocking. In terms of us being fresh, well, yes and no, really, I think. And there's there's space here, put it that way. There's a sort of freedom, but that theatrically can also be a disadvantage. I mean, instead of confronting things, you can go out in the bush, or there can be a layer of sort of culture missing here, I think, in terms of people's experience because of that. But that, you know, that's sort of discovered. But, you know, it goes every which way. I know when we were researching a play back in the, you know, the theatre group, we went to a festival in Poland in 75, and then we did a tour of Poland, and there are other sort of alternative theatre groups at that festival, and they were quite obsessed with the war and the death camps and fascism and so on. And when we came back, we thought we'd better sort of find out about this. So we did our own play on that topic and suddenly realised, well, colonisation is a sort of fascist process. I mean, all Hitler did was colonise Europe, really. And so, you know, those circles still exist, I think, even though we're Kiwis, we're not all that fresh.
Now, returning to New Zealand after your study, you worked for the National Film Unit directing documentaries and drama productions, and you actually directed Sam Neill in his first motion picture. Is that right?
Yeah. Well, Sam was worked for the film unit as well, and he was in the theatre group for a year and a bit. Then we did the Landfall, slightly cheekily, and Sam was in it, yeah.
Right. What are some of your memories or other memories of that time?
Well, it was a good time for me because it was the film unit wasn't used to doing drama in any shape or form, and it was a period of sort of relative freedom because you didn't have to hunt for the money. You know, the money was there, the equipment was there. And it was quite a very good period for New Zealand television. There was one channel, black and white, and everyone watched it. You know, everyone watched the same thing. And because there's only one channel, there was, you know, there weren't those commercial pressures, and they had to have a diverse range of stuff. And Michael Scott Smith, he was the head of documentary for television, and a very progressive head. I mean, he just commissioned stuff, and so I you know, got these commissions, and you had a fair bit of freedom just to go and do what you felt like doing. And there was some very good stuff done, I think, in that period of time.
And it's all gone downhill since.
Well, in a sense, yeah, because as soon as you got colour, it became more expensive. As soon as you get two channels, you've got that choice.
And too much reality.
And people, you know, everyone would watch something. And gone up north, quite a complex form, and yet people were perfectly happy about that. And next day, everyone goes to work and discusses it because they've all seen the same stuff.
Now, you formed a theatre troupe in Wellington in the early 70s, as you alluded to before, and a lot of the work the group performed was influenced by the Polish theatre director and theorist, and I hope I pronounce his name right, Grotowski.
Yeah.
Could you please tell us a little bit about him and the effect he had on your approach to theatre?
Yeah, well, we were working initially in sort of improvised documentary sort of theatre. You know, we did the Depression, we did the 51 lockouts and so on. It was getting a little bit, I don't know, sort of run the mill. And then Grotowski's book, Towards a Poor Theatre, turned up. And he was pretty amazing because he researched the place of theatre in, you know, the world of television and film, that growing world where there's so much performance happening. And he was also very rigorous in terms of the research and actor training and performance. And this notion of you strip away all the dross and all the rubbish and what are you left with. And for him it was the encounter between the actor and the spectator at a really deep level. And that certainly appealed to me. I mean, it struck some chord in me, and it meant that as a group we could work with sort of real discipline and diligence, and it was a sort of exploring in terms of that connection that theatre is based on, really. And so, yeah, it was a good period. By the end of it, we'd probably sort of lost our audience a bit because I mean, Kotowski eventually gave up performing for an audience and just went into, I mean, I suppose just that exploring of performance almost for yourself as a sacred act. So, but yeah, it stayed with me as you know, that formal exploration and a sort of intense truth, if you like.
Brilliant. Now, I don't know if you described yourself as a cultural activist or somebody else did, but could you explain exactly what that is? Because a lot of your work is quite political with social messages.
Yeah, well, I suppose, you know, as a person who's brought up in a working class family, then you do realise that there's a lot of... the art scene, if you like, is pretty much a middle-class scene. You know, that's part of a middle-class culture rather than sort of working-class culture. And that contradiction was always there for me in terms of who you're doing it for, why you're doing it, what's the point of it. And eventually... I mean, initially I was a sort of lefty, I suppose, always, and you say the right sort of thing, but then you know, what does that mean if it's still going to a middle class audience, really?
Right.
So, it gets quite theoretical, but do you think of culture as being a production process? And, you know, who you're doing it for, who's doing it, what are the relationships in that process. And that drew me into, I suppose, community-based work in particular, because there you're working with a community group of some sort and in a reasonably equal fashion, and you're producing some work that is about their experience in the world, which they can participate or certainly watch, and that's democratic. It's a sort of democratic cultural experience, put it that way.
Right, thank you for clarifying that. Now, you've had three books published, Tornado and Other Stories Written Over Time, Coal in the Coast, and Rebellious Mirrors. Can you tell us a little about them, please?
Yeah, well, Tornado was just a short stories that was published in Nelson by Tai River Press. Eva Brown, who's, you know, is a colleague and get on well with Eva. And I mean, I'd sort of start to write the odd story along the way, I mean, as well as the theatre scripts and film stuff. And I think I won a top of some writers' competition that was Nelson. I came up and read it at the AGM, I think, of the Society of Authors branch. And Eva came up afterwards and we started to talk. And she's a great editor, and so we got that book of stories together, which was really nice.
Great. I'm sorry, we're starting to run out of time, which is so unfortunate, but would you like to read a little bit, a passage or two from one of the books, please?
Yeah, I'll just read a couple of pages from a story that was sort of on radio a while back. It perhaps gives sort of flavour of trying to sort of write something about the local culture, you know, about what surrounds me. It's always interested in the warehouse in Greymouth. It's sort of so significant. So this is just about a girl who works in the warehouse, and is also about someone the DPB thing and the line of women who have babies. There's girl in red. I walk across Cobden Bridge on my way to work. The wind's blowing. Even on the finest day, the wind blows. I watch the dark flow of water. There's something inside me, some possibility. Mistake, of course. Near head, getting pissed and dancing a slow number, head on chest, lights dimmed. Ended up parked down the beach in the back seat of the Lancer, suspension lowered, big bore exhaust, boom, hiss. I watched the grunt of emotion on a still boy's face, indrawn, sea sound on rock. Jake was his name, apprentice Sparky. Then we drove home, silent as a church. I walk across Cobden Bridge, concrete and grey, wondering whether I should go and get the morning after pill at lunchtime. I feel the wind tug at my hair, body, soul. I don't want a bath, but a baby, like Mum and Nana. A line of singles. It would be something, a more than me, sucking, wanting. I want to be wanted. I want to want. When I got home, it would start to rain. I'd washed them away, but something inside of me felt different, some trickle of sensation, some glow. Chantelle's told me about the morning after pill. Don't have to go to the doctor, just a chemist to look at you briefly, then tell you to use it only as prescribed, even give you a glass of water so you can take it there if you want. Bingo, lotto, or whatever, or you can take it home. That's the story. What to do? A boat of, I know, chemicals, hormones, whatever makes you feel crook for a day, then you're okay. Turn left, walk down to the Red Castle. A truck from China's pulled up at the loading bay and the forklift takes out sheets, pillows, duvet covers, outdoor furniture, LCDs, carpets, garden hoses, computers, tents, pens, pencils, fairies, balloons, dolls, magicians, I know it all. Aisle by aisle, name badge, login. Have a nice day. Of course it'd be a mistake, condemned for 20 years, DPB, but I can see the face of my boy girl looking at me special. Bugger it, Ray, grow up, teeth gone at 40. I climb the stairs to the staff room, put on some lip gloss, dare a look. I'm no magazine cover.
That was wonderful, thank you. Now, your latest show is Helen and the Ferals, which has been touring around the West Coast, and it's on tonight at the Mapua Community Hall at 7:30. Briefly, what's it about?
Well, we've been doing plays on sort of local issues down here, really, or things of local concern, and the story of the native logging controversy is pretty, you know, there's a big story down here, sort of from 1970 through to 2000, and I felt that it had led to very much to a sort of anti-green feeling down here because, you know, the logging was stopped, and so we just wanted to tell that story, really, and it's quite a big story, and it's always a matter of finding the framework for a story, and this one we thought, well, a punk rock group, the last punk rock group in town can tell this story. And Helen Clark had made that sort of iconic comment about coasters being inbred ferals at one stage during the controversy. So, yeah, I mean, a sort of notion of Helen joining the group eventually, and the group becomes Helen and the Ferals. And so we tell that story. It's a satirical piece. It's got lots of songs in it,
including The World Turned Upside Down by Billy Bragg, which is the song you've chosen for us to listen to today.
Yeah, it's one of my favourite songs, really.
Right, let's listen to Billy Bragg.
In 1649, to St. George's Hill, a ragged band they called the Diggers came to show the people's will. They defied the landlords, they defied the laws. They were the dispossessed, reclaiming what was theirs. We come in peace, they said, to dig and sow. We come to work the lands in common and to make the waste grounds grow. This earth divided, we will make whole, so it will be a common treasury for all.
the sin of property. We do disdain. No man has any right to buy and sell the earth for private gain. By theft and murder, they took the land. Now everywhere the walls spring up at their command. They make the laws to chain us well. The clergy dazzle us with heaven, or they damn us into hell. We will not worship the God they serve, the God of greed who feeds the rich while poor men starve. We work, we eat together, we need no swords. We will not bow to the masters or pay rent to the lords. We are free men, though we are poor. You diggers all stand up for glory, stand up now. Men of property, the orders came. They sent the hired men and troopers to wipe out the diggers' claim. Tear down their cottages, destroy their corn. They were dispersed, but still the vision lingers on. You poor take courage, you rich take care. This earth was made a common treasury for everyone to share. All things in common, all people one. We come in peace, the orders came to cut them down.
I'm Galen Pound and you've been listening to Top Writers. Thank you so much, Paul, for taking time out of your busy day to talk with us, and I'm sorry we didn't have longer. Now, as I said, keep saying, Helen and the Ferals is on tonight, Saturday the 9th of September at 7:30 at the Mapua Community Hall. And are there door sales available?
Yeah. It'll be mainly door sales.
Okay, thank you so much, Paul. A podcast of this and previous programs, upcoming events and information about Top Writers can be found on www.topwriters.co.nz.
Thanks to New Zealand On Air for making this program available through funding the Access Internet Radio Project. Cheers, New Zealand On Air.